I'm Chris Bend, a theological librarian at Vanderbilt University's Divinity Library, and I'd like to welcome you to another in a series of conversations about recently published or forthcoming books by faculty in Vanderbilt University's Divinity School and Graduate Department of Religion. Today I'll be talking with William Franke, professor of comparative literature, Italian, and religious studies, about his forthcoming book, The Revelation of Imagination, From the Bible and Homer, Through Virgil and Augustine, to Dante. William, thank you for being willing to be a part of this interview.
Thank you, Chris Benda. Very happy to do it.
Great. Well, we'll start right in with a question about how you got interested in studying the text that you talk about in your book. Your book comes out of a great books class that you've taught at Vanderbilt for some time, and among other things, it can be read as an apology for the importance of reading such great books, such texts. You suggest throughout the Revelation of Imagination, and particularly in the conclusion, what reading the great books does for us, but I'm assuming that your ideas about such things have developed over time and didn't necessarily initially motivate your own reading of these texts. Of course, that could be wrong, but I'm interested in what inspired you to begin studying these classic texts.
All right. This course was given to me when I came to Vanderbilt in the comparative literature program. This course was on the books. It's the core course, the flagship course is one of the terms that was used. And I took it over. I didn't really have the notion of the great books. I was not invested in that idea. When I came to Vanderbilt, the texts were set for the first course that I taught here. That's a given. Everything else I will justify theologically as destiny. But that really was handed to me. I picked it up and ran with it, and have built around that. It's what an institution like Vanderbilt traditionally offered and still offers, and I really learned what kind of an education Vanderbilt is capable of offering from doing this. It was the structure that I moved into. Of course, I came with a background in Dante, among other things. Dante and philosophy were really my two areas of specialization. Dante himself is, in many ways, the most canonical of writers. He himself is responsible for forming the canon of writers as we have it. He creates a canon, actually, in the fourth canto of the Inferno. He writes himself into the series of the great classical poets. So to that extent, as a Dantist, I'm predisposed to doing a course of this nature. And of course, then I put it in a philosophical framework to reflect on what the humanities are, what kind of knowledge they offer us.
The Revelation of Imagination, the book that you've written, focuses on five texts. The Bible, meaning the Hebrew Bible and the New Testament, Homer's Odyssey, Virgil's Aeneid, Augustine's Confessions, and Dante's Inferno, which you were just talking about. And you do really extensive readings of each one of these texts. In fact, as you say in your introduction, there are at least a couple of ways of reading your book, and one way of reading it is simply to read the interpretations that you do of these texts. Unfortunately, we're not going to be able to necessarily go into a detailed look at those readings, although you may want to bring out some of that in answering the other questions, the more general questions I'll be asking. Before getting into some of those questions, though, I wanted to ask you why these five texts in particular. I think most folks would agree that they're extremely important. You've just made a case, particularly for the Inferno. But you know, what about these texts gathered them together in your mind to write a book on them?
Well, they are epic texts. And it's the epic tradition, which in some ways lays a foundation for the study of the humanities. Homer had that role in the ancient world. It was the basic text that any educated person had to know. The Aeneid had a similar role in the Roman world, and even long after Rome, in the whole culture of humanism transmitted in Latin through to subsequent centuries. What distinguishes an epic text, among other things, is an aspiration to wholeness. There's something encyclopedic about these texts. Actually, that word, encyclopedia, has a reference to pedia, which is children, so it's about the education of children, and also the cycle. It is knowledge in the round, and it makes up a whole. These texts aspire to giving the whole of the cultures that they represent in essentials. Knowledge seen as holistic is something that is crucial to the nature of the humanities. There are numerous epistemological reflections on that. One could launch into at various times. But just to stay with the first idea, I think, of these as texts presenting knowledge as a whole, it's obvious for the epic narratives. It's less obvious for St. Augustine. If you're, the question is really why these five texts in particular. And Augustine was an addition that I made. The Confessions were not part of the course as I inherited it. But the Confessions, too, to my mind, are an encyclopedic work, apart from their educational value. After the first nine books of St. Augustine's autobiography, the last four books launch into a discussion of creation, of the whole of creation. They're exegetical, starting from the first verse of the book of Genesis, and they are speculative, raising questions about everything that enters into the mind, into memory, through perception, and then all of the faculties of reflection. Actually, all of the liberal arts and sciences are touched on in the latter books of the Confessions, which to that extent qualifies also as an encyclopedic work. These texts are offering a vision of the whole of reality, what in the German tradition is called die Gesamtwirklichkeit. That is what singles them out. Now, there are a lot of other texts, of course, that one could work with. These texts work beautifully together. They really do constitute a continuous tradition. And Augustine is very much part of it. The transmission from Homer to Virgil is very explicit. The Aeneid is really a reprise of Homer's Odyssey first, in the first six books, when Aeneas is traveling around the world in order to reach Italy, and the Iliad in the second series of six books, books 7 through 12, when the Trojans are fighting a war in Italy, a war of conquest. So it's very consciously a rewriting of Homer. That's also the case with Dante, but of course the biblical epic is part of it as well, so that you have those two epic traditions being synthesized by Dante. He's able to do it also thanks to St. Augustine, who adds a dimension of inner reflection, who reflects the entire field of knowledge covered by the epic or culture into a dimension of interior introspection and regrounds knowledge on the self-reflexivity of the subject in relation to a transcendent ground, who is God. And he gives a kind of philosophical depth 2, the sum of knowledge, all of these works being summas, but then reflected subjectively by St. Augustine, Dante picks that up and writes it into the epic tradition.
These, as you've noted, these texts, particularly the Bible, the Odyssey, the Aeneid, and the Inferno are exemplary humanities texts. What beyond the definitions that you gave, that kind of bring these texts together and identify them as these exemplary humanities texts, what other kinds of humanities texts are there? I mean, how would you define a humanities text, and what wouldn't count as a is there anything that wouldn't count as a humanities text?
Not necessarily, because it depends on how you read them, of course. And even the telephone book could be read in some ways that would be revealing of our humanity. So I'm not going to say that there's an essential paradigm or an essential definition of humanities texts. However, they are texts that concern, that are of general interest for forming the person, as opposed to being technical knowledge for specialized application. These books are instructive of how to live. And of course, anything, whatever, could be a basis for the kind of reflection that then turns it into a humanities text. But the humanities and humanities texts are always invitations to reflect upon ourselves. They're not only about the objects that are presented within them, their own contents. Humanities texts need to be approached as partners in dialogue. They are addressing us as readers. Texts become humanities texts when we enter into a dialogue with them, when we project ourselves into the worlds that they present, when we see the possibilities for existence that they represent as being possibilities for ourselves. They become then the means of our own self-reflection. Knowledge in the humanities is self-knowledge. Traditionally, that's called wisdom, sapientia. They always illuminate us, the reader, as well as the worlds that they're about. And they offer us worlds, infinite worlds, worlds of human delight. The human imagination, this is the kind of rhetoric that Blake rolls out for his encounter with the tradition of Dante, Homer, Virgil. They're all present in his works, to mention another humanities text, which would be part of the continuation of this tradition. Of course, Blake is building directly on Milton. Humanities texts offer worlds to us, and I would suggest that they offer us our own world, to come to our own world, to consciousness of our own world, as if for the first time, by encountering it through the lens of this other culture. When one reads these texts, one can underline how foreign the medieval world is to our modern or postmodern or post-postmodern mentality. And the same, of course, for the Greek world or the Roman world. And that's important. And scholars tend to emphasize that. And yet, it's always within the context of coming back to ourselves through this detour into other ways of thinking, other minds that are necessary in order to reveal us to ourselves. So the nature of knowledge in the humanities and the Geisteswissenschaften I'm thinking of Gadamer by using the German term. For him, all knowledge is hermeneutic. It's a matter of interpretation and ultimately of self-interpretation. And the humanities texts are the texts that really underline that. We might take an example from Homer, where the dialogue between Hector and Andromache, the moment at which Hector is about to go out onto the battlefield and lose his life in combat with Achilles, pitiless Achilles, and Andromache pleads with him not to do that because she knows or suspects what's likely to happen, and she describes in vivid detail what that means to her. It's the loss of everything to her. The loss of her brothers and of her parents, all of them are actually concentrated into Hector. Achilles has already killed her brothers, and he's going to kill, it's actually his son, Pyrrhus, who's going to kill her father and mother. But that is an invitation then to us to think of what it would be like for us to lose everything, whatever relationship for us is crucial to our whole existence. It's that kind of mapping of oneself onto the text that one's reading and appropriating its concerns into our own lives that characterizes reading humanities texts as humanities texts, to my mind. And I stress that the initiative is really with the texts. It's not that we examine them as specimens for analysis, but rather that we have to open ourselves to being interrogated by them. All right? Let them speak to us, in some sense, as the Word of God. And this is why the Bible is so paradigmatic for humanities texts, as I understand them. All of them have some sort of a word of revelation of a world, a truth, a possibility for being, if we let them speak with that authority.
Your mention of the word revelation moves us nicely into the next question that I wanted to ask, which has to do with terms from the title of your book. The relationship between revelation and imagination is central to what you're doing in the book, and that relationship seems multifaceted, at least in my reading. The title of your book, The Revelation of Imagination, could be referring at least to both the ways in which imagination is revealed in texts and over time, or it could also be referring, and it could also be referring to the specific kinds of revelation that are produced through the imagination, the imagination's revelation or revelations, mm-hmm. Again in texts and over time. And in fact, you state in your chapter on the Aeneid, revelation is imagination. You don't emphasize the is, but revelation is imagination, splendid and alluring, but ultimately also a phantasmatic construction. So I wonder if you could talk a little bit about what you mean by these terms, revelation and imagination, and how you see them relating to one another, and what they provide you and us in understanding and in arguing for the importance of humanities and the humanities texts and the humanities more generally.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think you're absolutely right to hear the title is working both ways, as a subjective and an objective genitive, in other words. Right? Revelation of imagination is imagination of revelation as well. Yeah. Each term really operates on the other. They have different emphases, of course. Revelation comes to us from above and beyond. It's usually, in some way, a message from heaven, the word of God. Whereas imagination is a human faculty that operates spontaneously, freely, right, without being imposed upon from without. It's unconstrained even by concepts and logic. It uses them playfully in order to invent and envision whatever it pleases. It's the human faculty of invention. Now, what I'm interested in is the way in which the two intersect, overlap, presuppose each other. One is always completely wrapped up, bound up in the other, right from the Bible itself. The text that in some ways has the highest claim to being a revelatory text, it doesn't exist without imagination. It's all conveyed through narrative and poetic forms of imagination. Revelation in all traditions, really, has been expressed in a great variety of forms of revelation. We're talking about the Quran, or the Upanishads, or the Chinese Book of Changes. All of them hinge on the ways in which what it is that they're trying to speak is expressed in and through the imagination. Now, the imagination, on its side, is not just a human faculty. It's always escaping from our control. It's open to suggestions and influences impinging from it knows not where. It's the nature, really, of imagination to be open to something other, something above it. This is figured consistently by poets as inspiration, right? The muses, there's a communication from divinity that is claimed because it's a testimony to the experience of the imagination as being some kind of revelation from beyond. So I'm insisting, really, on the way in which these two terms need each other, illuminate each other, and I would refuse a reduction in one direction or the other. If you take revelation as pure revelation and don't mix it up with human modes of interpreting, you cut revelation off from its own productivity, fecundity, and relevance. And likewise, if you take the imagination, look, it's only the imagination. Don't start talking about divine inspiration. Well, that's the attempt to draw a circle around humanity, to understand humanity in terms purely of humanity, and that is a vicious circle, really. It's a reductive circle. Humanity is going to be able to understand itself only as an openness towards what it does not understand, what is beyond it, what it is not. There has to be a relation that breaks through that self-enclosed circle that any definition gives us. The imagination is what breaks open our definitions and our concepts and enables them to communicate to what is beyond. And that's where authentic knowledge comes from.
We'll move to another concept that is significant. It doesn't appear in the title of your book, but it's significant throughout, extremely significant, in fact, in your readings of all of the texts that you look at, and that's the concept of prophecy. And you know, folks that are familiar with the Bible are certainly familiar with the concept of prophecy. They may have different definitions of it, but it's fairly evident in biblical texts. And you talk about how the role it plays in the Aeneid, for instance. But what I'm interested in is having you talk a little bit about how you see it working in all of these texts. And I'm thinking you had mentioned earlier about Augustine's Confessions sort of being the odd book out of these five. How in particular does prophecy work in that, or how do you see prophecy working in that particular text?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Prophecy does work differently in all of these texts. And I do give different definitions of it from text to text.
Mm.
Augustine, in particular, is talking with God in his confessions. It opens up with a prayer addressed to God, Magnus est Domine et laudabilis valde, right? Great art thou, Lord, and greatly to be praised. That's not just an epigraph. That is the beginning of a discourse that continues through to the very last words of the confession. It is of the confessions. They are spoken in a voice of prayer from beginning to end. All of the narrative of Augustine's life is in the form of a dialogue with God. So that Augustine is communicating with the divine omniscience as he relates what he himself knows and remembers about his life. He's always relating that to what God knows about his life, which is everything. And even though Augustine, with his finite mind, cannot comprehend God's point of view, he's communicating with God. He's, in some ways, telling his life from the point of view of God. That is, God's point of view is present, even if Augustine does not exhaustively grasp it. Everything hinges from that divine vision, sub specie aeternitatis. That is prophetic vision. Prophetic vision which sees history, or in Augustine's case, his life's history, from the point of view of eternity, sees all time together. Now, prophecy is more traditionally defined as the prediction of the future, right? Even though I like to hear in the word prophetes, phasis is speaking pro for. It's really speaking for God. I think that's what the prophet essentially is, one who speaks for God. Now, that might entail predicting future things, and we have a lot of prophecy in that form, although the crucial prophecies are not that. Even in the canonical prophets, Isaiah is prophesying, this is second Isaiah actually, the coming of my servant Cyrus the Persian, mostly after the event. And crucial prophecies tend to be after the event in the other texts as well. Certainly the Aeneid is all a prophecy of Rome set in maybe the 13th century BC, before Rome exists, because it's Aeneas as the patriarch, the forefounder, who is granted visions of everything that's going to come, right, in his genealogy or in his descendants. But for Virgil and his contemporaries, it's Roman history that has been prophesied. And yet, it's Roman history being laid out in relation to the final end and goal of it all, which is the Pax Romana, right? This great universal peace that's supposed to be inaugurated by Caesar Augustus, the one for whom the poem is actually written, by commission. And everything that happens in Roman history up to that point in some way has a prophetic bearing upon this moment, which itself remains future as much as present, because it's a challenge to realize this ideal that has been prefigured in Aeneas and his heroic actions, and that is supposed to be fulfilled by the Augustan age, but it's a challenge to make that true, because it's also in danger of being very, very false. And the Aeneid is constantly worrying over the ways in which the ideals of the Roman Empire are being betrayed. It is a scathing critique of the Roman Empire, at the same time as it exalts this vision of glory, which, however, as I suggest, remains a task to be performed rather than a fact, a fait accompli, right? Rather than an accomplished fact. And that is the nature of prophecy, to intervene into the present, to challenge us to realize the ideals of the past and to seize the promise of the future and make it real. Authentic prophecy is always placed in a context of action, of a present appeal to realize the vision which is being revealed from God as our highest calling and possibility. Right? And I do think that all of our humanities texts in some ways are prophetic in that sense. All right, this is the common sense. I do differentiate the meaning of prophecy from text to text, but I think that this really is a common denominator, and that the texts are prophetic from beginning to end in this sense. You know, all of the Bible is the Word of God, even though there are certain books that are prophetic, that are designated as prophetic. From the very first word, it's speaking in a prophetic idiom. And it's, I think, launching a prophetic appeal, right, in the sense of prophecy.
The some of the texts that you cover, the Odyssey, Dante's Inferno, are poetry, or what we would consider to be poetry. Some of the other texts, like the Hebrew Bible, contain poetry. You, however, see poetry in a seemingly broader sense in your book, beyond just the form that we recognize when we look at a page of text. What is poetry in your book, and how does it relate to these other terms we've been talking about: revelation, imagination, prophecy?
Well, that's an enormous question, and you know, right on target. That is really at the heart of my book, and I don't know exactly what angle to take up to approach it. I can say that poetry means making, right, in Greek, poiesis. And the making that's privileged is language. Language is the making of our world, right? I think this very often in Heideggerian terms. It's a crucial text by Heidegger on this topic is Der Ursprung des Kunstwerks, the origin of the work of art. In the work of art, and Heidegger does explain later why language is paradigmatic for all art forms. In some sense, language is the original artwork of the human race and of any culture. Its language is what makes all of the arts possible, because language opens the world. It gives us a world. The world is a disclosure of things in relation to one another. That's the essence of language, actually. This can come from the term lege, another essay by Heidegger. Legen means tying things together, and language derives from this idea of laying things out and binding them together. And that is really the nature of the world. The world is disclosed to us in language. This is also part of the humanist tradition, which Heidegger actually abominates. His letter on humanism is all a refusal of humanism. But on this point, they converge. The Latin humanist tradition also envisages the world as originating in language. The original founders of society are poets. And when we say world, it's different from earth, right? Nature as it is simply given. The world is some kind of a human construction of the real, an order of things that is made possible by language. And as I say, that insight is crucial to the Latin humanist tradition as well, which is woven into the humanities as I'm presenting them. So it's really in poetry, in language, and the essence of language is poetry, that is, language in its emergence, right, in being invented, that first reveals a world to us. It's a work of imagination. So poetry is really right at the focus of everything that I'm talking about here. And there's an aspect of revelation, you know, poetry. Poets themselves invoke always then the gods, the muses, in order to underline this aspect of the revelatory power of poetic language. There's also a narrower sense of poetry as certain forms of verses. That's relevant. It's revealing as well of the way in which language can become to us a revelation. Our own artifacts, the products of our own human intelligence, invention, show us to ourselves and show us in the context of a wider world. Poetry, this making of objects, starting with language as the original artifact, is the way in which humanities propose that we examine ourselves and come to knowledge of ourselves, right, through poetic making.
So just to follow up on what you're saying, you use the term poetry rather than the term language, because what the whole conception of making, I mean, where that enables you to go, rather than simply talking about all of these texts being language, you want to kind of emphasize a particular aspect of how they are language. Yes,
that's right. To emphasize imagination, revelation as absolutely crucial to language. What makes language to be language as opposed to simply random sounds? Mm-hmm. It is a work of the demiurge, if you want to think of it that way, and that's another term really meaning making. We make ourselves in language, we make our world in language, and we are made through language. Language makes us as well. I don't think that we're in control of it any more than Heidegger does. It really is a revelation for him. the disclosure of the world, but maybe also the idea of the world as being a world, that is, of being something whole, is possible through language. And I like to think of poetry. Well, poetry works both ways. It cuts both ways to bring all things together within some kind of a vision. Poetry also disseminates, it interrupts, it cuts. You know how the caesura is crucial to the working of poetry. Because the wholeness that we're talking about here is not a wholeness that can be grasped or encompassed. Language also is a breaking open to what cannot be said, what cannot be articulated in language. And a lot of poetry has to do with that interface with what is not only beyond language, it's really beyond conception. Everything that we do think and talk about is then converted into language by our very thinking. And yet we're aware of the ruptures, the interruptions, some mysterious side that always remains as a residue beyond what the nets of language are able to capture. So that language does offer us some kind of a wholeness. We find our way around in it. It forms a certain system. And yet the wholeness within which we live and move and have our being is really what language does not grasp, but enables us to peer out at. So there's an important issue here about the status of the whole. One of the things that's crucial about language, and here I would really shift from Heidegger to Blanchot, is that language is negation. The word is not the thing. Language gives us the world without the substance of the world. It's just the image, the copy, the sign. And that intrinsic negativity of language is actually what enables us to conceive of a whole. It's only in the unreality of language that we have any conception of a whole. The whole does not exist as concrete reality. It is made by the negations of language. This is a crucial idea, really, of Blanchot develops it, for example, in La littérature et le droit à la mort, literature and the right to death. He develops it from Hegelian premises. Hegel already emphasizes this dichotomy between word and thing, and the way in which the word is not the thing, the way in which Adam, when he begins to speak, he loses the world, right? He's not living in sensuous continuity and plenitude in paradise once he starts naming things, right? When the animals are brought to him. So this question of wholeness, which I did really touch on from the very beginning, because this is the conventional wisdom about the humanities, is that it provides us knowledge in the round. And that's true. It is a contextual, relational knowing that tries to grasp things whole, and yet the frustration of the grasp is crucial to the study of the humanities. And even in these texts, all of them, they are self-critical texts at the same time. They have to show their limitations, I believe. in order to be whole, in order to evoke a wholeness from beyond themselves, their own linguistic structures, the systems, and their closures that are created by their language.
That actually, what you were just talking about is something that you develop in the conclusion of the Revelation of Imagination, where you, among other things, do what I think is, to a degree, a defense of looking at these canonical texts, of taking these texts and saying these are texts that should be focused on, should be considered. They're important texts, and in doing this defense, you could also call it a reflection, but more strongly a defense, you are doing something that seems to run a little bit against the current critical scrutiny of canon, of, as you were just talking about, of wholeness. So in this kind of situation, can you talk a little bit more about how your particular way of advocating for these texts addresses some of the things that have been mm-hmm. said about the canon recently? And you've already done that, mm-hmm. I think, with regard to the concept of wholeness, but if you could talk a little bit more about that.
Mm-hmm. I don't necessarily intend this book as a defense of these specific texts, even though I am trying to bring out what is so creative and compelling about each one of them. That doesn't say that other texts might not be equally creative and compelling. I'm totally open to discussion of that. I take the verdict of tradition as suggesting these texts, as I said at the beginning, but were handed to me, as good ones to work with. Now, I do bring out of them a vocation to some kind of total vision. And I do want to defend that idea against the attacks that would find any form of totalization to be everything that's wrong with our, with our world, with our thinking. There are a lot of dangers connected with totalization. I think that this critique has been very necessary, very powerful, very accurate. But if you look at some of its main protagonists, like Walter Benjamin, in Thinking the Fragment, you'll find that he doesn't want to abandon the search for some kind of wholeness either. There are the motifs of the Kabbalah. There is a total vision that Benjamin in particular is extremely invested in. However, I would stress that this wholeness is actually won through self-critique, not through triumphalism, through claiming to have the answer to all questions. Quite to the contrary, it's an opening towards a universality that exceeds us. This is a new concept, I would suggest, of universality, and in some sense a non-concept of universality. I say new within our critical context. It's actually the kind of universality that I find working already in all these texts from the beginning of the humanities tradition. It's a form of universality that is always striving for a greater universality. That is, if we circumscribe ourselves and say, forget about the whole, about the total. That's the devil's temptation to try to think whole. If you give up that call, that criterion and exigency, I think it's an exigency really, of thinking, then what you have is warring universes. You don't have universality. You have different and incompatible paradigms that are going to face off against each other and plummet us into the kind of war of cultures that really threatens our world. What we need is a universality that is an open universality, that is actually a desire for the whole, that is open to that whole that is always greater than whatever has been achieved in one's own system and thinking. This is what the texts, and these specific texts, I would argue, not only, but in an exemplary manner, teach. Though it's not always the lesson, and it's maybe not even the lesson that's been most commonly derived from them in certain recent readings. That's why I wanted to stress the way in which it's a scathing critique of the Roman Empire, at the same time as it does envisage a universal reign of peace. That's what we're called to, but it's going to come about only through some very radical revisions of Augustan policies and ideology. There's a lament, the voice of lament that is whining through the text of the Aeneid from beginning to end. There's the public voice of triumph and the private voice of personal lament. Dante is every bit as self-critical. In fact, his claim to prophetic revelation is based upon systematic undermining of all of his own human capabilities and faculties, like writing, reason, rhetoric. All of the resources that he relies on are obliterated. That is, he shows in the Sinners of the Inferno how they're damned by having relied upon their own human prowess in one way or another. Brunetto Latini, Dante's own teacher, is condemned to hell, to the circle of the Sodomites, which actually is the circle for humanists, right? Pederasty was the occupational hazard, right? For professors in those days. And Brunetto is a humanist. He says at the end of that canto 15 of the Inferno that he still lives in his tesoro, which is the title of his book, Le Trésor. It was actually written in French, which is a kind of linguistic sodomy. But the point that where he cites himself and he feels that he still lives, actually he still dies in that book. But the ideal of the humanist was to eternalize himself in his own work. Now, you might think that's what Dante's trying to do. It is what he succeeded in doing. And yet, he's aware that that is a recipe for eternal death, not for eternal life. He's undermining precisely that ambition. Because if he's going to live eternally, it's not going to be by his superior poetic performances. That is the judgment of God, right? And the grace and the gift of God, who is alone Lord of life and death. And this is a self-critique of Dante. Actually, Dante is a character in this canto, in conversation with Brunetto. He praises Brunetto. He says, "You che mi insegnavaste come l'uom s'eterna, you taught me how man eternalizes himself. It's a reflexive verb, s'eterna. And as a character, he represents himself as a character not really understanding what has happened to Brunetto, that he's being, that he is condemned precisely because of this ambition, an ambition that Dante himself is very close to. This is one example. There are myriad examples. In fact, every sinner in the Inferno, in some ways, is a mirror of Dante and his own risks and hazards. And then, for us as well, right? All of these sins are potential pitfalls for each one of us. And this is how the text then interrogates us. It calls on us to interpret ourselves in a way that's going to avoid the pitfalls that have betrayed these various sinners into eternal condemnation. Actually, Ulysses is the figure in which with which this dynamic is most patent in the Inferno. But what I wanted to stress here is how the wholeness that these texts seek is not to be identified with the artifacts that they themselves present. They are texts that are open towards the other, to what they cannot express or comprehend or even fathom. I underline that in every one of these texts. That's how they can be made whole. And that's why revelation, inspiration, divine vision are essential to the operation of humanity's texts. If they are only humanity's texts, they will be vitiated as humanity's texts. They have to be open to this wider mystery that is interpreted in Christian theology, especially in the tradition here that I've been constructing as leading up to Dante. But of course, there are many other theologies that have brilliant resources for interpretation as well.
We, as I said earlier in the interview, we unfortunately weren't going to be able to focus too closely on specific readings, but I'm glad that you were able to talk at length about one of the texts that you focused on, because as I said, your book is largely readings of these five texts. And this last question that I'll be asking also doesn't really deal with the specifics of your readings. It's more a general question about something that you actually raise in the introduction to your book. I'll preface it by picking on a university that's gotten in the news recently, SUNY Albany, which is... suspended five of their humanities programs, including the classics program and the Italian program, where some of these texts would find their homes. And I don't, by mentioning SUNY, I don't mean to pick on them. They're just an example of the precarious situation in which the humanities seem to find themselves these days. In the introduction to your book, you talk about you make a distinction between the humanities and the sciences, and you talk about the specific kind of knowledge that the humanities produce. Can you talk a little bit about that knowledge that the humanities produce? I think you've already discussed it, and also how what you're doing addresses the devaluation of the humanities and or mm-hmm. what seems to be the devaluation of the humanities in the modern university.
Yeah. I want to see the humanities in relation to the sciences in the whole of knowledge. This is not to devalue the sciences, but to place them in their context as forms of human knowledge. What's happened throughout the course of modernity has been gathering prestige, a mounting prestige of science that has tended to eclipse humanities, which seem to be less potent, less exact, less reliable, less true as forms of knowledge than science. But there's a narrowing of our vision that makes us see it that way. And I'm proposing that we turn around our view on the entire spectrum of the liberal arts, which embrace both the language arts, starting with grammar, rhetoric, dialectic, through scientific matters, arithmetic, geometry, astronomy, and music too is actually considered a scientific material or a scientific subject in the Middle Ages and in antiquity already. In order to see how all of our knowledge is really leveraged from the humanities that reveal knowledge in its wholeness as a human undertaking. When we lose that perspective, the sciences are no longer working for us. They become tools that are powerful and can even work to destroy us. Right? That is not to diminish or to denigrate science, but to try to keep it together with the human context out of which it arises. That's the case historically as well, that the sciences, natural philosophy, arise out of poetry. I demonstrate this through revisiting the history of the relationship between the sciences and humanities, and show how natural philosophy, as the earliest science, grows out of poetic texts. I want to, perhaps read a couple of paragraphs
sure,
here.
Sure.
Before I do that, let me give an example here of a text that I think can encapsulate the way in which science and humanities really need each other. Think of the text from the 8th Psalm. The fundamental importance and basic human interest of astronomy here. I think I am going to then read a couple of paragraphs from the introduction of the book that are trying to explain the symbiosis between science and humanities that I'm trying to recuperate, really. And yeah, to that extent, I definitely am advocating the humanities, but certainly not in a vacuum. And as part of scientific knowledge, and really the more comprehensive part, these divisions are artificial. And in order to retain the whole sense of knowledge in our curriculum, we really need to embed the sciences in humanities. This means, for example, my thesis here about the historical priority of humanities and the sciences is growing out of them. This means, for example, that the fundamental importance and basic human interest of astronomy, its universal value, might be captured more effectively by a poem than by any astrophysical formula. The words of a poetic text like Psalm 8 communicate the overwhelming wonder of a human being in the face of the mystery of the universe. And that feeling of awe is what lies at the source of astronomical inquiry. When I consider the heavens, the work of thy fingers, the moon and the stars which thou hast ordained, what is man that thou art mindful of him? Or the son of man, that thou visitest him? It's interesting, just the last phrase, brings in the self-reflexive moment that I'm claiming is crucial to knowledge in the humanities, even in the psalm, the prayer to the Lord God. It turns out to be a reflection upon humanity. This makes it paradigmatic, I think, for humanities knowledge. Admittedly, it is possible to obtain from astronomical science much more precise information about the stars and their properties than is given in these verses. But does that added technical knowledge, for instance, in statistics concerning the stars' orbits and material densities, enhance the human being's actual experience of cognitive encounter with the phenomena of the heavens? Does it heighten the sense of belonging to an infinitely fascinating cosmos and the rapt wonderment through which the heavens are perceived as divinely made or as participating in the mystery of creation? It certainly could. The technical precisions of modern knowledge of astronomy are certainly awe-inspiring. But still, those who love science will not overlook its human dimension and rootedness. Otherwise, we risk suffering an immense human loss for the sake of a merely technical gain of scientific expertise. Knowledge, humanly considered, is valuable in proportion to the intensity and richness of the relationships it enables. In stressing the human significance and originally poetical character of all knowledge, whether personal or systematic, I wish to valorize scientific inquiry and research in a new and vigorous way, rather than to diminish or disparage it. Science is without doubt the most thought-provoking gnoseological adventure of the human race in modern times, and in certain respects of all time. It is the apotheosis of the speculative odyssey that began in Greece in the 6th century BC, with the first recorded meditations of the pre-Socratic philosophers on the general nature of things. Empedocles, Parmenides, they wrote in verse their poems. Actually, both of them wrote poems, or you know, their main works, De Natura, are in poetic form. The incalculable complexity and order of creation, as it has been progressively discovered by the more and more powerful instruments of science, from the microscope to the atomic particle accelerator to the laser beam, fill those who consider it with awe and coerce minds like Newton's and Einstein's, not to mention many more of humbler capacity, to see evidence that God does not just play dice with the universe. Yet in order to be this provocative revelation of the infinitely rich and intricate mystery of existence, science needs to preserve a sense of the human significance of what it discovers in probing with its methods and instruments ever further the facts and the matter, literally, of nature. A consideration of how epic poetry and pre-Socratic philosophy form matrices for proto-scientific patterns of thinking makes it clear that the history of science emerges from the history of the humanities. Thus, my purpose is not at all to denigrate science, but rather to bring out its original unity with human culture, broadly considered, and its integration into the whole spectrum of human knowledge. The predominant tendency to view all the various disciplines of the liberal arts as species or subspecies of scientific knowledge, more or less rigorous and pure, is perhaps irresistible. It is one more symptom of the cultural hegemony that science has achieved in our technologically driven and dependent and technocratically managed civilization. However, I am proposing that we can equally well view the humanities and their pursuit of a wisdom that reflects understanding of oneself in relation to the general order or disorder of things as embodying the spirit that pervades the entire gamut of the liberal arts. By inducing to empathetic participation in the experience of discovery, rather than by inculcating a detached domination over positively given fields of objects, the humanities most fully realize the values and virtues of all forms of liberal learning, including the scientific. Typically, the sciences objectify. They bring into sharp focus a certain field of objects, but they can tend to block out the human situation that is comprehended by the peripheral vision characteristic of the humanities, with their sensitivity to the unfocused background factors that count so much in determining the overall significance of any experience. In human knowing, there is always a subject who cannot be completely focused as object, but who is indirectly expressed in countless ways, as intimated, for example, by the tenor of a discourse and the effective nuances of its language, or is conveyed by perspective in painting, or by subtle orchestration of emotional tonalities in music. And this is poetry. All this is poetry. In humanity studies, we always need to ask what the human meaning and value of a given form or instance of knowledge is, for that is what makes it matter to human beings. Some sort of subjective view and knowledge of the world is expressed even in performance of a musical instrument, or in the choreographing of a dance, or in the crafting of artifacts. The knowledge involved in those cases is a little bit less graspable, and yet it's no less vital to what really drives and motivates knowledge. The humanities tend to get short shrift because it is more difficult to get a handle on them, but we have to develop our abilities, the finesse, l'intelligence de finesse. This is Pascal, who contrasts the science. He was a mathematician, and he knew all about the way in which mathematical reason grasps its objects with exactitude. But there was a certain finesse de l'esprit, a certain kind of finer knowledge that he needed in order to understand and or to speculate about theological matters. And the humanities are endangered, I think, by the subtlety, right, the fineness of the kind of knowledge that they offer. And we have to resist becoming so crude in our understanding as to no longer really appreciate how vital this dimension is to all human knowing.
William, thank you again for this conversation.
Thank you, Chris.
It's been very good. Again, I've been talking with William Franke, professor of comparative literature, Italian, and religious studies, about his forthcoming book, The Revelation of Imagination, From the Bible and Homer through Virgil and Augustine to Dante. If you have any comments about this conversation, just browse to the homepage of the Vanderbilt Divinity Library and click on the Contact Us link at the bottom of the page. We look forward to hearing from you, and thanks for listening.